Well, and the really important thing is to keep the big picture in mind of what is it we're going to do going forward. It's good to think about, okay, this is how we got to where we are, and pay homage to the golden calf to some extent, right? And say, you know, this was what was great about what we did. But now we're here. We're at a whole different place. 25% of the church is disaffiliated. Our budget is this. Now, where are we going to go from here? How is this going to work?
This is Dennis Shaw. I'm the host for Mindful Leader. And welcome to episode 21. I'll get to discussion of some of episode 21 in a few seconds, but I wanted to sort of go back over a little bit about how I got started, where we're going with this. The original idea behind Mindful Leader was I was going to focus on the topic of stewardship and money management at the local church. I grew out of that rather quickly. And I decided I wanted to have more of a focus on church leadership in general. And my objective was to create material that was time independent. What I mean by that is that you could listen to episode 14 in October, or you could listen to episode 14 in July. It didn't make any difference. But that having been said, there are times in the life of the church, both locally and more nationally or globally, that there's times to stop and talk a little bit about things that are going on in our own time. Today's episode is one of those. Now, I love baseball. But I always found it hard to watch baseball that Tim McCarver was announcing. The late Tim McCarver was announcing. He mostly did the World Series. And he would announce the game as if somebody had never seen a baseball game in their whole life, people watching the World Series, which was probably valid. We're going to have some issues here. It's going to be a little inside baseball. And part of things I need to make sure we talk a little bit about here is some of the ideas that we're going to frame, but they're inside baseball. And so we may use terms that are sort of like watching a baseball game, and you may go like, what does that mean? What is a bunt? And we're going to be using the same kind of ideas. My guest today is Gayla Jo Slauson. She's a retired professor at Colorado Mesa University in Grand Junction, and she worked in the business world. She taught business, and I have found her just to be a delightful person to talk to. She has been one of the co-lay leaders of the Mountain Sky Conference since 2018. And she is a delegate to General Conference in meeting in Charlotte, North Carolina, in late April and early May this year. Normally, General Conference meets every 4 years. We have this thing called COVID that happened in 2020, and so the programmed 2020 meeting did not occur. And so we're going to meet in 2024 with the delegates that were elected for the 2020 gathering. I try to stay with it where I talk about General Conference and don't put a date on it. But that's a lot of how we got here. We use a term in this conversation like jurisdictions. The United States is busted up into 5 jurisdictions, and their names are really creative. They are geographical. They are things like northeast, north central, southeast, south central, and western. And we will talk a little bit about that. There are rules that we have with the appointment currently of bishops that going across jurisdictional boundaries is challenging. It's hard to do. And it was created that way in 1939 when we created the Methodist Church. We'll also use a term called central conferences, and that's a term that refers to overseas gatherings or groupings of churches. Our conversation is going to focus on things that might be. It's legislation that has been proposed. It's certainly not yet been approved. And then within that, there's two categories of legislation. Legislation that can be approved by the General Conference, and generally, most of that can be implemented fairly quickly. And then there's others that has to be, that's approved by General Conference, but then must be also further approved by the voting members of annual conferences. That's the regional bodies that we have that helps deploy resources. So those are constitutional changes. And so they're a bigger deal and they're a little harder to do. So we have some changes that will occur as a result of general conference. And then there are some changes that might occur as a result of general conference pending the approval of other bodies. During the conversation about bishops, we will keep using the term life tenure, life tenure, life tenure. We don't literally mean that term in the context of how you mean life tenure for the Supreme Court. They're not bishops functioning in that role as a bishop until they die or leave. Once a bishop, always a bishop. And so that's what we're driving at to some extent. Right now, bishops have to retire. They do have a mandatory retirement. And the math on that, they could be as young as about 69, 68, and have to be mandatorily retired, or they could be as old as about 72 and have to be mandatorily retired. So there is a window there. I told you it was inside baseball. Kayla Jo and I start talking from an outline and we operate from that. But at some point in the conversation, we sort of depart from the outline and it moves to a place of where this is two people who like each other and respect each other are sharing their views about certain things. I won't put a bell inside the conversation, but it will get to a place where I think you'll feel this transition, this change. Without further ado, I am Dennis Shaw. I'm the host of Mindful Leader, and this is Mindful Leader. Thank you for listening. Let me welcome you to Mindful Leader. My guest today is Kayla Jo Slauson. She is one of the three co-lay leaders of the Mountain Sky Conference, and she is a delegate to General Conference 2020, which is going to meet in 2024, caused by the COVID crisis. We've pushed it back and pushed it back. And so this is actually the General Conference 2020. And the committee that she's on is going to talk a little bit about bishops. And Kayla Jo and I've exchanged email notes and had a little bit of a conversation back and forth. Welcome to Mindful Leader, Kayla Jo. This is your second time on the show. I'll owe you a t-shirt or a coffee cup once you get five visits.
Well, that sounds good to me, Dennis. Thanks. I'm excited to be here just to visit.
It's always fun to talk with you. I enjoy it. As we looked over the petitions that are there about bishops and what's going on, I was struck with an element of these petitions. Of course, I was not aware of a previous history of this, but there appears to be a lot of conversation going on in this area around the word accountability. Around the word accountability. Would you agree with that with me?
I would. I think definitely we're seeing that. And a part of it is money driven. I mean, when resources get tighter, you have to have more accountability on how they're going to be used. If you had plenty, I guess, you might be less concerned about that. But accountability, I think, is in our leadership. We look to accountability in our country. We're hoping that we can count on people. And so accountability is just an important aspect right now. But I do think in this particular set of petitions, we see a real emphasis from people putting forward ideas on we need to have at the highest levels, our leaders need to be accountable.
And there appeared to be a couple of ways they were approaching this. One, for example, was that the Council of Bishops could say, by some level of vote, two-thirds vote, something like that, that you need to move to retirement. We're going to have a vote and we're going to move you to retirement. And that appeared to be like one of the ideas that was out there.
Right. That was an idea. One idea was every year your annual conference had to vote. I mean, all the members have to vote. And
to keep you.
Basically, yeah, positive affirmation. And some of the approaches have to be with having maybe changing the ways we do elections and having an election every 4 years so that you're accountable in the sense that you may or may not get reelected. there's that too. Life tenure seems to be not a thing that people want to continue with bishops.
I have been in choirs before, audition level choirs, where every 2 or 3 years you have to re-audition just to sort of make sure your voice is still capable of carrying that. The idea of the fact that somebody is a choir member or a part of an orchestra that they still have to be able to carry their load is not a foreign concept to me.
No, it isn't. Although I can tell you after going through with Episcopacy Committee and being on the Western Jurisdiction Group, I just think that having elections every 4 years for bishops would be, oh, I mean, it just makes me cringe. I agree. Yeah. There's you need to still be able to do the job, but man, oh man, is that a tough process? Not to mention, I do think there'd probably be some temptation to campaign.
Yeah.
Squeaking in there because.
Vote for me. I've done a good job at the Mountain Sky Conference.
Right.
Yeah. But for example, there's been a couple of ideas there that like one has been the fact that if there's a shortage of bishops in one jurisdiction or one wherever we're going to end up with the term regionalization, which is a different conversation, that you could move an overage bishop to another conference, to another jurisdiction. You're smiling. I'm seeing your.
Well, I am smiling.
Nobody else will be able to see the smile, but I can see the smile, which is like, right, great idea.
Yeah, I mean, I just see problems with that. I think when you're living it, you realize that sounds good. It sounds wonderful. Oh, we're just gonna, they're all interchangeable. And it isn't quite like that. And if you had a bishop in a jurisdiction, and it was maybe the toughest bishop that people had trouble with, I mean, it seems like that would be the one you would want to ship off. You're not going to send your best bishop to another jurisdiction, right, Dennis?
Right.
So it doesn't sound, at least from those making the decisions about where the bishops go. I mean, if I didn't elect a bishop, I didn't help elect a bishop, and then I get one foisted upon me because someone sends, I don't know.
Well, trust is in low supply in the country. Exactly. Writ large.
Yeah.
That having been said, the idea of jurisdictional elections of bishops came out of the merger of the Southern Church and the Northern Church and the Methodist Protestant Church in 1939. Mm-hmm. And the supposition in the 1930s was that people from one region of the country would not be able to really understand the nature of that constituency across boundaries, across enormous geographical boundaries. And I wonder if that's still not an element of truth. You and I chatted back and forth about a little bit about size, but I live now in the East, and I will say to you, the idea of the fact that Iowa is as large as it is. People think of Iowa as a small state. It's larger than every state east of the Mississippi River.
I didn't even know that.
Yeah, almost every state west of the Mississippi River is larger than any state east of the Mississippi River. And of course, the Mountain Sky Conference is four states plus a county of Idaho. And any one of those states is larger than any state in the East. And some of those states have two conferences in them, some three conferences. Right. So they have a very limited appreciation for the geography.
Right. And it seems like back there, I mean, you're in West Virginia and I have a daughter in Virginia, and from her house, there are three Methodist churches within a couple of miles.
Yes.
I mean, they're all over the place.
Right.
It's a whole different thing to do. I just think the economy is a scale. You have to take into account the geographic distance too. Even though we have, you know, digital meetings and so forth, it's still, you have to take into account that.
I live in a county of 60,000 people, and there are 19 United Methodist churches in this county.
Wow.
60,000 people, 19. Now, most of the 19 are 2-point, 3-point charges, but you can do that. Whereas in Wyoming, it's got like, I don't know, 33, 34, 35 churches, the whole state. And
right.
coupling together 2 and 3 point charges is like 60 miles apart.
Right.
So, yeah. So accountability appears to be one element. I know there's some general dissatisfaction with certain decisions that were reached over the COVID years. I'm not sure how many of those are still pressing upon people. Another one seems to be the issue of either, you can either call it term limits or you can call it tenure. But how long does a bishop serve? Is it 8 years? Is it 4 years? Is it for life? Right now it's for life. I mean, I say life, they are until mandatory retirement,
right,
which is the quadrennium they would reach 72 in. They have to retire before that.
Right. Yeah, there's, if you were thinking about term limits, and you have to figure in retirement as well, but I know that it's hard on those younger clergy who are thinking about or being nominated for bishop to think about life
as
tenure as a bishop. Whether is that even reasonable? And is it reasonable, maybe less reasonable now than it used to be? And of course, you have the money situation and what happens after people retire too. I mean, you continue a certain level of support for bishops. And so there are some petitions too along that line that aren't so much in accountability, but what happens after a bishop retires and how much do they continue to be participating in decisions about bishops and things like that. But also just the idea that is life tenure something that, I mean, we have it with our Supreme Court, I guess we have life tenure. But is that something bishops, or why did they have, I always ask the question, why did we have life tenure for bishops? Do you know the answer to that?
I don't. Probably somewhere along the line, we'll discover that John Wesley wrote it down on a note to Thomas Coke and said it was a good idea. And it's now inscribed in who we are. I don't know. I mean, I'm not sure why life tenure or was part of being a bishop. I know for the Supreme Court, they have this lifetime tenure in order to sort of remove them from the political day to day, so
right.
they're not subject to being voted out after 4 years or something like that. Although there are states that do indeed bring their Supreme Court justices up for periodic review. So,
I think the 4 year thing. I do think 4 years is too short. The proposal to elect every 4 years, I mean, you have no chance to be in a jurisdiction and serve in more than one conference. Unless you got reelected, you'd always have to be getting in new. I don't know. I don't like the 4 years, but I think at least 8 and maybe 12, or there's one proposal that's talking about 8 years and then you could be reelected for 8 more. one time. But I like the 12 in a way, because 12, you know, everybody, it just comes and goes and ends, and you can't get reelected. There's no need to campaign about how great I was or something.
You're sort of term limited the day you're elected.
Right.
Tell me a little bit about this with the younger clergy. I guess would you really want to be a bishop knowing that you have to go through this meat grinder of the various elements of leadership of the church for 24 years? But maybe you're signing on for 8. You could do it. I can do this for 8, or I could do this for 12. So yeah. You might get a different group of people that might say, yeah, I could do this for 8. And then I could go back to the local church.
Right. And there were people in our last bishop elections that we interviewed and talked to, and people that expressed some of their concern about, especially if you have a young family, maybe you're 30 years old, you know, and you, you're thinking, man, am I going to, so when you look at how tough being a bishop can be on some people, you think, really, am I going to put my family through that for the rest of my life, or the rest of my career, at least, and until I retire and my kids will be grown? And, you know, that's a huge investment. And we say, you know, we believe, and I might sound skeptical here, but we really do think we're asking the Holy Spirit to guide our elections. And so sometimes, though, after somebody's been in a position for 8 years, they're not the same person they were when they started. It's not a good thing to keep them there for 20 more years.
Here on the East, in the East, I worship up and down the East Coast, and I do occasionally have lunch and conversations with pastors that are in conferences that are not the Mountain Sky. And they occasionally get bishops that are on a rehabilitation transfer. They haven't done well in blah, blah, blah. And they get a bishop that is sort of a second chance for that bishop to perform. Mm-hmm. And you wonder, I always believe in redemption. I'm a huge believer in redemption. And I'm frankly in the local church level myself. I have my own personal redemption story. But at the end of the day, I was redeemed at a fairly low level on the food chain. Mm-hmm. And whereas a bishop, you'd like to believe that if they came up short after 8 years at wherever they were, that if it's necessary for them to return back to the local church, I'm substantially older than you are, but we used to have a concept of the Peter principle, which was you got to a place where you exceeded your capability and you stayed there. And right. maybe sometimes the people that are bishops are just great local church pastors, or they're mm-hmm. great conference administrators. But somehow when you get to the general superintendency role, they struggle. And they can't. Am I making sense?
Yes, you are. And I think if you could have been a wonderful bishop for the time that you were first in for some length of time, but things do change in people's lives. Big things happen and little things happen. And it's not so much what the past was like, it's what do you do going forward? And it may not be the right place for you to be. And it's awfully tempting to stay there if life tenures an expectation of the role.
And a number of the petitions looked like it would give various levels a certain amount of authority in order to be able to say, Bishop Slauson, it's time for you to retire. We have decided and you don't get a vote on this.
Well, that's what was interesting to me, is so many of the petitions were like, you know, this, it's just going to be this way. They're going to say this and you're going to have to retire. You don't get to say much about it. You don't get to do much about it. I thought that was interesting.
Yeah. Well, it It could be the fact that we need to move through this. My experience in the military was is that as we downsized the military, we had to suspend some of their retirement rules for a little while. And that people that had an expectation of 28 years of service only got to serve 24. It was the needs of the service dictated. And maybe that's when we elected you bishop in 2016, we thought we had capacity and now we don't. And maybe it's the right time for us to make some of this decision. I know that there was some recommendations in there. I'm going to use the term grandfather, but it could be grandmother as well, but where they're going to sort of allow certain, if you've already been elected, the new rules would not apply to you.
Right.
I saw some of that go by.
Yeah. If you're elected before 2024 and it was life tenure when you were elected, then you would stay there, but all the new ones would have a different situation. 12 years and it would end.
If it's approved. Now, one of the, and I meant actually on my notes, I wrote down, talk about this. I was actually going to talk about this almost at the very beginning. There's a certain amount that General Conference can do. And once they reach the decision on it and General Conference ends, and it's been approved at General Conference, that's it, it's over with, it's been approved. And there are other elements that the General Conference approves it to a certain level, but then it has to go back out to the various annual conferences for a follow-on approval. And those would be constitutional changes.
Yes. Yep, and there are several limit, but Bishop, term limits and so forth that are constitutional changes, and they have to go to the each of the annual conferences
for their vote.
Yeah, they do. So whether they would pass at that level is a whole nother question.
The current limit, the current floor of each jurisdiction must have at least 5. That's not constitutional, is it? That's disciplinary.
I believe so. And it's interesting how there were some petitions saying, well, we might change that. And we're only going to have 4 instead of 5. That's money driven, financial considerations. But, that really hurts us, I think, in the Western jurisdiction, especially when they start tying it to numbers of people. When they start saying, and then they'll say if it's below a certain number, we're going to, maybe most jurisdictions get 5, but if you have less than a certain number, you're going to be forced to share with a bishop, kind of like a joint, bishop thing. And you're going to have to do that regardless of what that does to your numbers for the jurisdiction.
Yeah. We sort of in conversation, if you can yoke 2 churches together and we call it a 2-point charge.
Right.
We sometimes use the same vocabulary to talk about bishops, that they have 2-point charges. So they have Conference A and Conference B. We're now the Mountain Sky Conference, but there was a time that the Denver area was both the Rocky Mountain Conference and the Yellowstone Conference. Mm-hmm. So it was whoever had the Denver area was yoked with 2 conferences. They had a 2-point charge.
Yeah, and that's still true in the Pacific Northwest.
Yes.
They have multiple.
They have 3.
Yeah, 3 conferences. One of them is a missionary conference in Alaska.
Yeah.
But 3. Yeah. There was one, there was a proposal too that each jurisdiction could have 5. And if you wanted to pay for it, you could have another one, if you could say you needed it, but you would have to pay out of your own annual conference for that bishop.
Yeah, I saw that one go by. For the audience that may not realize this, I have been on the Conference Council of Finance Administration twice, 8 years each time. And as I see that one go by, my first reaction was, it would seem like you would be allowed to do that if and only if you paid 100% of your general conference apportionment. So you would need to be, otherwise you're just diverting money from various other funds to fund your own parochial need for a bishop.
Right.
To me, it's theoretically possible, but there would need to be some speed bumps you have to sort of get over before you should be allowed to do that. That'd be my reaction. There was your comment about money. I thought was interesting. Again, I'm sort of a money nerd, and as to the best of my knowledge, I haven't seen a detailed budget proposal for the period 25 to 28, which will be voted on at General Conference in April, May in Charlotte. But I just know that the various things I've seen go by, at least part of the issue is, how many bishops can we buy? How many bishops can we afford? And that appears to be an awful lot of the factor of what's going on here is that trying to figure out how do we go from one number to a smaller number.
That and they want to give the central conferences more bishops. I mean, there's been a sense that they didn't have enough. And so how do you can't do both, really. I mean, how are you going to give more bishops to the people that seem to need more bishops? And then in the local standpoint, how are we going to reallocate them so that we don't have so many because we can't afford them?
Yeah. I perceive that some of this is going to come down to a dollars decision. It's going to be how much money do we have? And that's going to sort of feed in to everything else. We're going to come up with a number based upon how much we can afford.
Maybe, although I often am surprised because of my business background and teaching in business. I also tend to have this, I don't know, tendency to think about money and how we can afford things and how we can budget things. But what I often see is a lot of aspirational goals, like I sound extreme here, but we're going to appoint bishops based on missional, you know, goals and that, and we're not, it's more like we're going to, I don't know, trust that the money's going to come in if we just do this. And I just think I just don't see it the same way. It's not the way I would do my household budget, I guess. And
well, I saw an article, I want to say it was about a year ago. It was talking about at the current levels of spending, they're sort of going to run out of money for bishops by the end of 2026. That was the number that I saw go by. So that will sort of get your attention when you're starting having to write the checks and you see you've got a run out of money line, run out of money date.
Right.
Hypothetically, December 31st, 2026. I'm not saying that's the date, but it was somewhere out there. It gets people's attention.
It does. And it also is kind of spooky if you're a bishop and that's sort of your career to think about my career is at stake. And it also clergy. I mean, I think when they talk about pensions and how can they afford that and all those sorts of things, you just think, yipes, was this the right career to even get into? This is feel very secure.
In your, and I don't want to ask you to violate a trust or anything like that, but in your banter, in your email conversation, your Zoom meetings with some of the people that you've been meeting with over the last period of time, as you sort of get ready for General Conference 2020 in 2024, what are some of the things you're hearing in those conversations that you'd be willing to share?
About what specifically?
About the subject of bishops and how many and retirements and accountability. And
well, one of the things that I have heard, and I don't know if it's it's people worrying unnecessarily or not, but I have heard this idea more than once that they won't let us do an election, perhaps because they'll say, well, we have bishops that need a place to be because of all the disaffiliations in some of the other jurisdictions. We need to be able to send them. And of course, the Book of Discipline, current Book of Discipline, could allow for that. Yeah. So they'd say, well, we're going to have to reallocate, and you just simply cannot. And I guess we'll find out soon enough if they'll let us elect, because our bishop is retiring this year, right?
Right.
So we're going to find this out. But I don't know, but I've heard that a lot, Dennis, and you know, from different places. So there's really, that's really is something that I sort of half expect, I guess, because I've heard it so much.
So example is that if I give you back numbers that come out of Wesley Seminary from the Lewis Center for Leadership, they've done some analysis which says about 25% of all of the churches in Methodism have left, and a corresponding number of members have left, 24%. I consider 25%, 24% to be an insignificant difference. So we've lost about a quarter of the number of churches and people, but they're not evenly distributed. A large proportion of that one quarter of all the churches in the United States Methodism have left, but the vast majority of that 25% are in the Southeast and the South Central jurisdictions. In other words, Southeastern United States and South Central is Texas, Louisiana, Arkansas, Nebraska, up in that area. So if I'm hearing you right, once all the dust is settled, they might look up and say, South Central has one bishop too many. And Western jurisdiction, we're going to give you one of the South Central bishops. Is that a fair statement?
I think that's one of the concerns. Yeah. Whether we should be so concerned or worried, I don't know. But there certainly is this feeling that, this could happen. This could happen. We could be sent someone and we don't know who, and they're from a whole different culture and expectation. And what would that do? There's just that sense.
Yeah. And the issue about the culture, I have some friends that are district superintendents outside of the Western jurisdiction. They are in Virginia and Louisiana and North Carolina and places like that. But it's very different being a district superintendent in those locations. And so the culture, as you said, is different. So you'd run the risk of having and maybe it actually would work to the positive, but you'd have a bishop show up that doesn't know anything about the Western jurisdiction.
Well, and what you bring up that could be to the positive, I keep thinking, one of the petitions suggested that bishops transfer, that each jurisdiction would have a counterpart in a different part of the world. And they were suggesting we swap bishops. And part of that was for unity, the idea that, we could have a bishop would really learn about this other place and the culture. And then the African bishop or whoever came to us would learn about the culture here. And we would have, there is the possibility that it could be educational for the bishops and the people and everything else. I personally think it's about the opposite of regionalization, though, in the sense of dealing with leadership. I mean, if we feel like in our region we need bishops that understand our context, and that's more like educating the bishops, but how does that help us in the short term anyway?
I've actually talked with people on an idea of the fact that maybe the right way for us to move in this downsizing of bishops is to allow the bishops or encourage the bishops to be more the general superintendents of the general church. and that the conferences take on more of a responsibility themselves for the management, vision, leadership of themselves. So the laity and the clergy of the individual conferences take on a lot of the bishop functions that are now done, now performed, and it's done by ourselves, and we allow the bishops then to be these integrating elements, sort of the board of directors, if you will, integrating across the denomination.
Mm-hmm.
That's an idea I've thrown out there, and it always falls flat. Nobody likes it.
It falls flat, and people don't like it. But so important to consider, because it's just the way it is. I mean, I think the role of the bishop is changing, and maybe the role of the clergy is changing for many churches as well. And we've got to look ahead and say, where are we going from where we are? Not we can't be stuck in the past on this is the way we've always done it. This is the way the bishops have, this is the way the role of a bishop has been. And I think your ideas are spot on what's, we're going to have to consider some different models and ways of thinking about it. And the conferences themselves, just like the local churches, are going to have to take more of a leadership role in what do we want to become. We can't wait for a bishop to set the stage and set the tone.
Yeah. I'm too old right now, but even if I were younger, I don't think I'd ever be a candidate to be a bishop. But to me, I would think I would personally find it joyful to be elected a bishop and then arrive at a conference who has a clear self-identity. It knows who it is.
Right.
And then my role is to help listen to that. And then if what they think they are is not who they are, be prepared to challenge them on that. But then the other component is that how do we communicate that vision so that it becomes a broad enough vision that everybody picks it up and says, yeah, this is who we are.
You mean within the conference?
Within the conference.
In the conference, yeah.
Yeah.
And I'm not sure everybody in the conference does or will have the same vision. I'm not positive of that. So
they won't.
but at least understands the conference vision and is.
And maybe this is, I'm using the terminology wrong, but I'd like to believe that we're all part of a tribe called Methodist. All right.
Uh-huh.
That's our tribe. But then we have different clans within that tribe. And those clans are artificially placed in places like we do it for money reasons in part. So we don't have to have 5, 6, and 7 conference headquarters. But we join together Montana, Wyoming, Utah, Colorado, and one county of Idaho. But there's really multiple clans inside there. And I mean, you and I've talked about this, I think, before. The clan that is in Boulder and the clan that is in Colorado Springs are very different.
Yeah. And the clan in Kalispell, Montana, and the clan even in Grand Junction, Colorado.
Well, people listen to the conversation here that don't live in the West won't necessarily understand this, but from a political perspective, you live in Grand Junction,
yep.
Which is highly suspicious of growth of growth along the Front Range, which is Denver, Colorado Springs, Pueblo, because in order for those places to grow, they have to get Grand Junction water.
Yep.
And so water becomes a big deal. And so we talked earlier about lack of trust. There's just a general lack of trust between Eastern Colorado and Western Colorado, at least as it relates to water issues.
Yeah, for sure.
And so you have a different viewpoint of the world. And so, like you said, it goes back to you have a different clan. They see the world differently.
Yep.
Is there anything that we should have talked about in this time about bishops and General Conference 2020 meeting in 2024 that I forgot to bring up and I should have?
Well, I think you covered the things I was had on my mind. I'm interested in the petitions that say things like that. Well, there's one from actually out of the country that I thought was really interesting that was saying when we go to elect bishops, we simply cannot elect bishops under guidelines that are illegal in other places. And I think some of the other mainstream denominations have bought into that when they change some of their rules. So I'm interested in those kinds of things. I'm interested in how, you know, every single one of the committees that's out there is going to have to deal with regionalization petitions. And even the stuff we're talking about with the bishops, there's so much of that is impacted by whether, right, you know, whether we actually get the regionalization stuff to go or not.
And you've actually anticipated where I'm trying to go. I'm trying to put together either a panel discussion or a discussion from somebody going to General Conference about regionalization. I know that there's was that series of the Answer Man or Ask the UMC or something where somebody out of Nashville talked about regionalization for 4, 5, 6 episodes on national news. National Methodist News. But yeah, I want to talk about regionalization. I think it's sort of worth an entire conversation, an entire 30, 45 minutes.
I agree.
Because it's
a big deal. It's such a big deal.
It's a huge deal. Just,
there are so many questions that really come into play when the more regionalized we get, the more we wonder how much connection we need, or I don't know if that's the way to say it, phrase it, but how connected will we even need general conferences, or will we just have regional conferences if we really come down to it?
And that's a good question. And the answer to that is I don't know.
Yeah.
I don't know. But I imagine it'll get resolved at some point. For those of you that are curious, and I don't have my regionalization thing all lined up, but the idea behind regionalization is simply that we would move to a way of treating regions of the world as self-governing entities. That's sort of the way I think I understand it. And so the United States, instead of it would be a region. And then right now, the central conferences, they have the capacity to modify the Book of Discipline as they see fit based upon local circumstances. And part of the regionalization would allow that to occur. I think part of the scary thing, scary is my words, I'm not sure anybody else agrees with it, but we've gone through the chaos of disaffiliation. We've lost 25% of our churches, 24% of our people. And we could come up to the next general conference and the values of many of those that left could still be retained by general conference because we can't reach the thresholds that we need to make the changes necessary to create a new visionary church. We'd be the old Methodist Church instead of the new United Methodist Church. Just to be the old United Methodist Church.
Yeah, I don't know that if we have enough people who are supportive of the regionalization in the internationally to make all those parof it happen, because there are bunches of legislation that would have to pass.
There appears to be a certain amount of the regionalization, which is an assumption for us to be able to move in certain directions. And I wonder where we're going to be at the end, middle of May if those don't pass. What's going
to
happen?
Well, there? Yeah. And then the call to have another general conference is partly because, assuming that they pass, then there's so many things that change that we'll have to deal with.
Have to sit down and regroup.
In 2026. But if they don't pass, then, I mean, there's just so much up in the air. It just feels so, it's hard.
Well, one of the daily devotionals I read is Richard Rohr. He's a Franciscan Catholic. out of Albuquerque. And last week he talked quite a bit about order. And his theme was about the idea of we have our order that we're used to, but sometimes life presents us circumstances where that order has to be disassembled. And so we have to go from order to disorder and reorder. Mm-hmm. And I think that what we've done these last 4 years or so has been about the disordering. We're in that state of disordering. And now we're entering into a period of reordering. One of the beauties, I think, of the Bible is how many of these stories, almost all the stories, can talk to us in our present time. The one I love is the one about the golden calf and about how you could treat the golden calf as an element of nostalgia. Back when we were in Egypt, we at least ate, things were hunky-dory and just wonderful, so we'll make this golden calf and we'll be like everybody else. And I just wonder sometimes if nostalgia isn't our own golden calf, and we're going to have to sort of move through some of this period of reordering, of disorder, in order to get to reordering. So we go from order, disorder, reorder, and I think that's sort of where we are, and we haven't gotten to reordering yet. We're not there.
No, and you know, had General Conference 2020 really happened in 2020, the protocol probably would have passed.
Yeah,
and we would have been in a different situation then. Now we're at a different place. Some of the petitions we're looking at were written back in a different time, even, and so
it's almost like you ought to take those and bundle them up and say, these were pre-disaffiliation. And right. So we're just gonna vote them all out.
And the really important thing is to keep the big picture in mind of what is it we're gonna do going forward. It's good to think about, okay, this is how we got to where we are, and pay homage to the golden calf to some extent, right? And say, you know, this was what was great about what we did. But now we're here. We're at a whole different place. 25% of the church is disaffiliated. Our budget is this. Now, where are we going to go from here? How is this going to work?
Yeah. And I think, as a numbers guy, there's so many unknowns right now. We talk about the 25% of the church is left with 24% of the people, but that doesn't really mean, that's not really 100% accurate, because you could have a church where the church decided to stay, but there were people, individuals in that church who left because they just could not buy in to what was the theology of the group that stayed. So we're going to, and then some of the churches that voted to leave, you see the story in I think it was Amarillo, where every church in Amarillo that was had a United Methodist affiliation left. Mm-hmm. And so they had to create some United Methodist presence in Amarillo, and they did it. Episcopal churches gave us some space in some of their buildings, but that's sort of how they did it. So that's the other side. So that's a church that left, but all their people didn't leave.
Right.
So it's all part of this. It's all part of the disordering.
Well, that and just take into account the decline in mainline
in general.
General, and when you put both of those on there, it's kind of a difficult budgeting issue.
Well, I guess I have faith that the decline will be turned around someday. I just don't know when it is. I'm not sure I'll be alive when it happens, but I think it'll eventually be turned around.
Mm-hmm. People need the Methodist theology. I think they do.
Well, it's interesting you say that. I was at Price, Utah, and we were having a clergy meeting in Price, Utah. We had gone to see the pastor there. There was about 8 or 10 of us that had gone to see the pastor there, and we went out into this very LDS community to have lunch. And we had name tags on, and we wore crosses. The LDS don't wear crosses. And one of our waitress asked us who we were. We told her who we were. And she began bragging on the local Methodist church about what a difference it was making in Price, Utah. Huh. And it was fascinating. She was just, she was preaching the Methodist story about the positive presence that that church had made in Price, Utah. And it was like, wow. It goes back to what you were saying, that the community of Price needed the Price United Methodist Church.
Yes.
So, oh, well. Gayla Jo, thank you for your time. I appreciate very much you giving it. And I just want to say thank you to everybody for listening. And I don't know exactly who was going to be my next visit. I'm still working that out. Gayla Jo, thank you for your time today. Peace be with you.
Thanks. It's been great to be here, and peace be with you too, Dennis.
God bless.